The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, I think we'll get started. Thank you all for coming. I guess we could, you know, when it comes to Q&A time, we can just go one by one and you guys can ask all your questions. It'll work out well. Today's event is on the Waite Court and the Legacies of Reconstruction. I am Steve Vladek. I'm an associate professor here at the Washington College of Law, and I want to thank all of you for coming. I also want to thank our special event staff for doing their usual stellar job on finding really, really bad for us cookies and good fruit. I thought I'd sort of briefly introduce where this event came from before turning to our featured speakers for today. So Professor Dodd and I have the unfortunate quality of being next door neighbors for offices, which means that I just yell at her and she ignores me. But we both teach constitutional law, and I think we both are fascinated, her because of her research and me just for fun, by the Reconstruction period. By the period of American history, loosely beginning right about the end of the Civil War, loosely ending sometime thereafter, you know, sometime between the disputed election of 1876 and, I don't know, Plessy. And what's fascinating to us about Reconstruction is that, in a way, it's impossible to understand where current constitutional law is with regard to the 14th Amendment without understanding this formative period, without understanding the forces that led to the passage of the 14th Amendment, without understanding what was behind the various Supreme Court decisions dealing with all three of the Reconstruction amendments. And so, you know, there's not that much attention paid in most constitutional law classes to this time period and to the broader historical surroundings, and really to more than just very, very quick synopses of these major cases. What we know from the very, very short, quick, and dirty version of history is that these were bad decisions. So the Supreme Court's decision in the Slaughterhouse cases in April of 1873, effectively reading the Privileges or Immunities Clause to mean very little. The decision right about the same time in Bradwell versus Illinois, enunciating the idea of separate spheres for women and how the analysis would actually differ because of the need for law to protect women in special ways, a very sort of patronizing and paternalistic approach to gender equality. The evil decisions the same day in 1876 in the United States versus Cruikshank and the United States versus Reese, dealing with the 15th Amendment and with interference with voting in the reconstructed South. And finally, the truly evil decision in the civil rights cases in 1883. Hopefully you realize by now I'm being slightly sarcastic. But this is the conventional account. And so what we thought would be fun would be to bring together three people who actually know something about this period, other than me, I just make it up, to talk about these cases, to talk about where they came from, to talk about what they actually decided, and if they so choose, to talk about why we should still pay close attention to them today. So what we're going to do is we're going to have each of the panels speak for some indeterminate period of time, after which point we'll have a moderated Q&A, and then hopefully if you guys are still here, we'll have some questions from you. I thought what I would do is I would introduce the three panelists just briefly right now and then give you a little more details before they each speak. So going in order from the end, we have Mr. Charles Lane, we have Professor Pamela Brandywine from the University of Michigan, and we have our very own Professor Linda Dodd. And Chuck is actually going to go first. Chuck is a member of the Washington Post editorial board, and he's also the author of this really interesting and provocative book, The Day Freedom Died, The Colfax Massacre, The Supreme Court, and the Betrayal of Reconstruction. He's previously the Washington Post's Supreme Court correspondent, editor of The New Republic, and a foreign correspondent for Newsweek. He graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Harvard in 1983 and then made the far better choice to study law at Yale, and he is a D.C. native. So it's my pleasure to introduce Chuck Lane.
Thank you very much, Steve. I hope you'll excuse me. I got a little bit of a cold. I'll do my best to speak in clear and audible tones all the way through, but I may cough or gag at some point. I'm very pleased to be invited to participate in this panel. I think I can safely say anyone who's not here is going to be really sorry they missed it, because this is actually, Steve is right. This is this period is the key to understanding how our modern constitutional doctrines originated, and to some extent how they developed in later years. I don't know what that old saying is, as the twig is bent, so grows the tree, or something like that. But certainly the ideas, concepts, and indeed mistakes of the authors of these Civil War amendments and the Supreme Court opinions interpreting them have a lot to do with how they've affected us in our own time. So I'll jump right in and explain to you about the case that is the subject of my book, The Day Freedom Died. And that is the innocent-sounding case, United States versus Cruikshank. And to just give you a little hint of why I got interested in it, it was very much for the reason Steve suggested. When I was covering the Supreme Court in the early part of this decade, it was going through a period in which the court was articulating a kind of new doctrine in federalism that was kind of re-elevating state sovereignty to a more privileged position in the law than it had enjoyed really in the 60s and the 70s, and was reaching back under the leadership of then Chief Justice Rehnquist to a whole series of cases from this very period to find authority for this judicial movement. And one of the cases that seemed to show up from time to time was this odd one called U.S. versus Cruikshank. And so I sort of got curious about what it was all about, and I'm now going to tell you what I found. And I think you'll find it partly shocking, but also partly, I think, a very good lesson in how abstract constitutional doctrine really is from historical events, and how once it finds its way into case citations decades and decades later, all the underlying facts are forgotten. The case, U.S. versus Cruikshank, emerged from an event known in its own time as the Colfax Massacre. So what I'd like to do is explain to you the events of the Colfax Massacre and then the significance it had as through U.S. versus Cruikshank. Well, in 1872, this is all in the state of Louisiana, which at that time was about just over 50% black. It had a black majority, and together with white Republicans, it had a majority of voters in favor of what I guess in today's terms you would call a progressive view of civil rights and the rights of the newly freed slaves. But in the election of 1872, the Republican majority was essentially thwarted through a lot of measures, mostly fraud. And the result was eventually that the state government was installed through federal force of arms, through the U.S. Army, basically, in March of 1873, but the rural local governments were all still up for grabs, including the disputed case of a little county called Grant Parish, located right in the center of the state of Louisiana. And the Republicans who had been elected there had not been allowed to take possession of the courthouse, which was not a very elaborate building. It actually used to be a barn or stables, excuse me, on a plantation, but had been, you know, pressed into service as a courthouse. And so late one night, they, in effect, sneaked in. They occupied the building with the help of a young boy, as mentioned in the old records as a quote-unquote colored boy, who they lifted up, put through the window, and he went down in the stables and opened the door from the inside, and the Republicans, white and black, took possession of the local government. This caused an outcry among the whites of Grant Parish and the surrounding parishes in central Louisiana. And within days, I'm telescoping a lot of information here, they had organized a large assembly of armed men, probably about 150, the vast majority of whom were former Confederate soldiers and officers and very heavily armed, most of them with at least two firearms. And they eventually approached the courthouse, which by then had been sort of reinforced by a group of almost entirely black men, much more poorly armed than the whites. And on April 13th, 1873, which was, as it happened, Easter Sunday, the white paramilitary force delivered an ultimatum to this group, telling them to get out within 30 minutes or else, and to give up their weapons as well, or else they would be attacked. Well, the black force, having seen that in the previous days some unarmed blacks had been killed in the surrounding countryside, refused this ultimatum. They actually expected that U.S. soldiers were going to come and rescue them. And sure enough, the whites attacked. And this sort of battle ensued, not much of a battle. It was a very one-sided battle because the white force also had a small artillery piece, which they used to very great effect. And within the next few hours, the following things happened. First, the whites outflanked the blacks who were defending this courthouse and forced them to sort of run and abandon the position. And then they shot a number of them dead while they were running away. The second thing that happened was that the white force reassembled around this courthouse, where by now about 60 or so of the black men had sort of taken refuge inside. And then they torched the courthouse. And the way they did that was especially cruel, I might say. They took one of the black prisoners that they had and forced him at gunpoint to walk about 100 yards to light the roof of this courthouse with a torch. And so when the courthouse began to burn, the men inside had no choice but to surrender, and they were promised that they would be allowed to live if they surrendered. And of course, when they ran out, you know what happened. They were shot at, you know, sort of indiscriminately as they were fleeing. And probably another dozen or so, maybe even more, were killed in that phase. And then at night, probably about three dozen or perhaps a little more than three dozen men were killed that night after they had been taken prisoner. They were marched out in pairs and shot in the back of the head with pistols and small arms like that. By the time it was all over, according to the best estimate I could develop from all the documents that were available from that time, I would say the minimum number of dead was probably 62, and a reasonable maximum number would be 81. But nobody can say with any certainty. I'm pretty confident that the lower number I've given you is accurate. The higher number has been questioned, but I think that's probably the range. In any case, this was the most bloody day in the entire Reconstruction period, which I'm sure you all know was characterized by a lot of violence across the South. In 24 hours, that many people killed. And it was a sensational event all across the country. The newspapers covered it. And back in those days, newspapers were still pretty hot. We're considered passé now, but it was the state-of-the-art communications mechanism. And the Telegraph carried this news to every corner of the country, and there was a great demand that something be done about it. The Grant administration was in kind of a predicament because they had used the Army in conjunction with federal law enforcement authority to crush the Ku Klux Klan in South Carolina during 1871 and 1872. And that had proven very successful but also very controversial. There were a lot of people who objected to this kind of what was thought to be very heavy-handed use of federal authority, federal force, and a lot of people who thought it was a risk reigniting the Civil War. So the solution that was hit upon to deal with the Colfax massacre was to engage in a federal prosecution under the authority given by a statute called the Enforcement Act, which had been enacted in 1870 pursuant to the new 14th and 15th Amendment, and was really designed to give the federal government some mechanism to punish this kind of terrorism short of, you know, kind of an all-out resumption of war. And basically what this statute did was it said anybody who conspires to violate the rights that are protected by the 14th and 15th Amendments has committed a felony. And what was really interesting about this statute, as it was later amended, is that it said anybody who commits a state crime, such as murder, or it could be robbery or something else, assault, in the course of this conspiracy is liable for the penalty that would pertain under state law. So in other, most cases, that would be death for the crime of murder. And the U.S. attorney in Louisiana at that time, the state capital was New Orleans, so it was located in New Orleans, was actually a northerner who had transplanted down there before the war, a man called J.R. Beckwith, who was, for, you know, bless his heart, was extremely upset about this massacre and very determined to do something about it. And again, cutting a long story short, despite a lot of threats from the armed white groups in Louisiana and a lot of bureaucratic sniping from Washington, he managed to get 100 people indicted for this offense and actually bring 9 of them to trial in New Orleans by the time 1874 began. There were 2 trials. The first ended in a hung jury, and the second ended in the conviction of 3 of the 9 conspirators, including Mr. Cruikshank. I mentioned this phase of the event in which people were lined up 2 by 2 and shot. That was an event that was Mr. Cruikshank's idea, actually. And so it was considered especially important to have him on trial, and that was one of Beckwith's successes. But they were only convicted of a lesser charge that did not carry the capital punishment. And even that was considered outrageous by most of the whites in Louisiana. What was a special quirk of this second trial, and really an historical accident, was that it occurred in May during the period when Justice Bradley of the Supreme Court, Joseph P. Bradley, was riding circuit, as they used to do. And so he sat on the trial and ruled on defense motions. And after these 3 men were convicted, they moved for what was called arrest of judgment, a motion in arrest of judgment, essentially to throw out the convictions on the grounds that the statute, the Enforcement Act, was unconstitutional. And Bradley held that though the act was constitutional, he held that parts of the act were constitutional, but one part was unconstitutional in that it did not specify that these crimes had to be motivated by race. And furthermore, there were many segments of the indictment in this case that also did not specify a racial motive, and therefore the whole indictment was no good. So you had the justice of the Supreme Court saying, well, you know, sure, these guys were killed and everything, but this U.S. attorney didn't say it was on account of their race. And that was the only thing that was forbidden, that the Congress had the authority to forbid under the 14th and 15th Amendments, because in his view, the 15th Amendment only established a right to vote free of racial discrimination as opposed to a right to vote per se. The Supreme Court heard the you might well ask, well, why did the government even get to appeal this to the Supreme Court, because I thought acquittals weren't appealable. But in those days, there was a system called in which there were 2 judges on trials, and the other judge sitting on this trial with Joseph Bradley did not agree, and this created what was known as a division of opinion. And based on their division of opinion, it was appealed to the Supreme Court, where I'm afraid to say there was no division of opinion. The court ruled 9-0 to essentially, and I'm telescoping a lot, we could, if you're interested, talk about it in the question time, to essentially uphold Bradley's view of this statute. And the significance of this was that it imposed a requirement on federal prosecutions in such cases that they prove that these acts are motivated by racial discrimination. And if you think about it, superficially that sounds reasonable enough, but if you think about it, it's always would have been extremely difficult to prove because of the racial polarization in voting in the South, among other reasons, that almost all blacks were Republicans. And so it could always be claimed that they were killed because they were Republicans as opposed to the fact that they were black and that sort of thing. The impact of this on future federal prosecutions was twofold. First of all, between the time Bradley had ruled in the circuit court, and the time the Supreme Court ruled, there was essentially no law in the South because there was a circuit court ruling saying the statute couldn't work. And so the federal government suspended whatever it was doing to prevent racial violence in the southern states, and as a result, or in part as a result, Mississippi was, the Republican government of Mississippi was overthrown in 1875. And then after 1876-77, these statutes were essentially dormant. There were some efforts made to keep prosecutions going, but the results were very paltry, and a lot of it had to do with U.S. versus Cruikshank. So I try to think to myself, well, how could the court and Joseph Bradley have thought they were doing the right and decent thing here? I mean, in part, I want to believe, and there's some evidence of this, they were not fully aware, even though Bradley had sat on the case, fully aware of all the facts of the case. And that's a long shot because they've been very well publicized in the press and the rest. But I think what Bradley and some others on the court thought they were accomplishing here was a compromise. I think they felt that if they preserved some federal authority to prosecute in cases where there was a racial motive, they were fulfilling the purposes of the 15th Amendment, but without opening the door to sort of wholesale federal usurpation of the traditional state authority for law enforcement in criminal cases. And in our eyes, that seems like a patently a bad bargain, especially in that particular case. But one has to remember, and I'll explain in a minute why I don't think this excuses what they did. One has to remember what a truly novel idea federal law enforcement was in the 1870s. I mean, basically before the Civil War, there really was no federal government in most parts of the country. I mean, there were a few army outposts and customs houses, and that was about it, the post office. The U.S. attorneys were isolated, lonely figures who did admiralty cases. And so this whole concept that out of Washington you would suddenly have a police force going to work was a difficult idea even for a lot of Republicans at the time to sort of fully get their minds around. But I think in a way I'll explain now why I don't think that excuses it, because I think there was another kind of compromise that Bradley and the others on the court also had in mind. And it was a broader, sort of more like compromise of 1850 kind of a compromise, which was, look, we have just gone through this bloody Civil War. We've had this difficult experiment with Reconstruction. It's clear that whites and blacks can't get along in the South without a lot of violence. Do we really want to get back into that bog? You know, do we really want to rekindle all of that conflict for what? For the sake of a few black people to be protected in their right to vote? And I wouldn't necessarily attribute that motive to everyone on the court, but I really think, and I could explain this later if there are questions, but I don't want to take all the time. I think there are clear indications in Bradley's own personal record and his personal writings and his personal approaches to the whole issue of slavery that suggests that was really something that was very important to him, this idea of pacifying the country, of not, you know, through the court, not kindling new conflicts, but instead finding elegant ways to prevent further conflicts. And if that had to be done sort of at the expense of this federal authority to protect civil rights from these kinds of crimes, so be it. And I obviously think that had very, very unfortunate effects, both in the short term and longer term as well. So I'll stop there, and if you want to ask anything more, I'll take those questions in the question time.
Thank you. Our next speaker today is Professor Pamela Brandwein from the University of Michigan Department of Political Science. Professor Brandwein's research focuses on constitutional law and politics, constitutional development, and civil rights. She's the author of the award-winning book Reconstructing Reconstruction, The Supreme Court and the Production of Historical Truth, which examines the institutional establishment of an error-ridden account of 14th Amendment history and the way this account rendered war and court rights expansions vulnerable to the charge that they were the result of politics, not law. And she's currently working on a book that rethinks conventional wisdom about the court settlement of the great debates involving race, rights, and federalism opened by the Civil War. The book offers the first major legal and historical rethinking of the 14th Amendment state action doctrine. And then the process transforms the standard view that the state action doctrine represented a definitive abandonment of the freedmen to Southern home rule. Professor Brandon.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you. Thank you all for being here. I absolutely agree that Cruikshank in the civil rights cases and state action doctrine has been revived as an important doctrinal pillar of the federalism revolution that the Rehnquist and Roberts courts have been accomplishing. And so the state action cases are newly relevant. And where I come at this from is the argument that it's in fact anachronistic readings of these cases which have been so important. What I've been doing in this project for the last couple of years is recovering an old legal language, an old set of legal categories, and placing them in relationship to a newly emergent political history that has been written about this period, this new political history that's coming out only really in about the last 6 or 7 years. And I'm telling a new story about these cases, and I'm going to talk today only about Cruikshank, but I can certainly answer questions about the civil rights cases as well. So the bottom line that I'm going to be talking about in my next 15 or 20 minutes or so is this idea that the Cruikshank case has been legally misread, that Bradley's 1874 circuit opinion is actually a milestone in the development of American constitutional law, that this circuit opinion developed three very important doctrines for the time. One of them was a 15th Amendment doctrine, one of them was a 14th Amendment doctrine, and another one had to do with Article 1, Section 4 that concerns the federal regulation of national elections. And I guess the upshot in terms of Cruikshank is that when the federal government continued to prosecute voting rights cases after 1876 into the late 1870s and into the 1880s, they were using a theory of rights that traced back to Bradley's 1874 opinion. Now, this theory of rights that the federal government was using, that the Department of Justice was using, had to do with the 15th Amendment and Article 1, Section 4. So I'm going to talk about that this afternoon. But the jump-off point conceptually for this reinterpretation of Cruikshank is the Compromise of 1877. Now there was a disputed election of 1876. The conventional view that Steve mentioned is this idea that the Republican Party abandoned blacks to Southern home rule as part of a so-called compromise. The Republicans would get the White House, but they would give up civil rights enforcement in the South. This is the Compromise of 1877. And this is a view that comes from C. Van Woodward. It has been embraced by lawyers, historians, political scientists, and it has been used to explain Cruikshank. The idea is that while the Republican Party abandoned blacks politically in 1877, and state action doctrine and the court and Bradley consolidated this abandonment in Cruikshank and then later in the civil rights cases. Now, in the past 6 or 7 to 10 years, there has been a new revisionist literature about political development and about the Republican Party between 1877 and the early 1890s. And what this new revisionist literature shows is that, in fact, the Republican Party did not definitively abandon blacks in 1876. President Hayes articulated a new reconciliation policy. He was roundly condemned for this at the time. But what happened was that after the elections, in the midterm elections in 1878, Hayes reversed course. The Republicans took a beating in this election, and not only had they lost control of the House of Representatives in 1874, now they lost control of the Senate in 1878, and they were profoundly worried that they were about to lose the presidency in 1880. And Hayes reverses course, and he says, you know, my reconciliation policy was a mistake. It was a failure. And he ramps up enforcement. You also have an episode, which I'll talk about in a little bit, involving Attorney General Alfonso Taft in 1876. This is that fall after the Cruikshank decision was decided. Taft uses Cruikshank and Reese to justify the massive deployment of federal marshals in the 1876 election. So I'm going to be sort of telling a story about how the Republican Party continued to, in fact, protect black voting, not nearly to the extent that the party did during Reconstruction. There's actually a transitional period in American politics, and this transitional period has not been very well understood. You have the height of Reconstruction, the height of enforcement in 1873, and then enforcement declines substantially. By the time you get to 1876, it's very, very low. But then it picks up again. It picks up again after the 1878 midterm elections, and in the 1880s, President Garfield and President Arthur reassert some effort to protect voting rights. And it's really not until the failure of the Lodge Bill in 1890 that you do see the definitive abandonment of blacks to home rule. So there's this new revisionist political history that shows us there is, in fact, a transitional period where the Republican Party in the late 1870s and 1880s is no longer the Republican Party that it was. It's no longer the party of Reconstruction. But it is not yet the Republican Party of the 1890s that doesn't care, that does abandon, that is the party of big business. And what I do with this Cruikshank material is situate the case within this highly unstable, changing, transitional political context. So the sort of the bottom line from the recovery of this political history is to set out two alternatives. The first one is that either the Cruikshank decision and state action doctrine is at odds with the Republican Party. You know, if the Republican Party did not, in fact, definitively abandon blacks, could the court have definitively abandoned blacks? Could the court be working at cross purposes with the party? And that, in fact, is a possibility. But there's another possibility, and that is that the legal elements of the Cruikshank decision, in fact, have been misunderstood, and that the decision is actually in some kind of harmony, symbiotic relationship, that the court is actually trying to still help the party. And this is the idea that I put forward. So I recover, and I'm going to talk about this, I'm going to sort of pivot to talk about this, the legal dimensions of the case. And talking about the legal dimensions of the case involves recovering these old legal vocabularies. There's actually an old 19th century language of rights that we no longer use today. We recover that old legal language, we put that together with this new story of the political context, and we actually come to see that the electoral federalism decisions that were won by the Department of Justice after Cruikshank, a case United States versus Butler, 1877, nobody knows about it, ex parte Siebold, ex parte Goldman, ex parte Yarbrough, late 1870s, 1880s decisions. The key point is that it's the theory of rights that the Justice Department used in these decisions. This theory of rights actually traces back to Cruikshank, but this has not been recovered in the legal literature. So Cruikshank is, part of the legacy of Cruikshank is that they set free these Southern killers. But the legacy is more complicated. There's actually quite a nuanced picture of the decision that we can recover once we recover these old legal languages. So Cruikshank, I'm suggesting, is not a definitive abandonment. And what it in fact did was signal the Republican administration of Hayes, of Garfield, of Arthur, about these legal doctrines that were available to the Republican administrations. And I'm going to be suggesting, and I'll get to this at the end of the talk, that the court was signaling the administration in shorthand, in a legal shorthand that was made possible by Bradley's 1874 opinion. Now, Cruikshank should not be seen as a victory. It was not a victory, but it also was not the end doctrinally. And there's this middle ground that I want to paint a picture of. So let me turn to the legal dimensions of Bradley's 1874 opinion. As I suggested, this is really an unrecognized milestone in American constitutional development. Bradley's developing this jurisprudence of rights. And this jurisprudence of rights consisted of three dimensions. He articulated a concept that I call state neglect, number one. He articulated a concept that I call the 15th Amendment exemption, where he exempted the 15th Amendment from state action rules. That sounds weird, but I will explain that in a second. And he explicitly signaled that there was power under Article 1, Section 4, which is the Times, Places, and Manners Clause, that permitted the federal government to regulate national elections with plenary power. They didn't have to wait for state behavior of any sort. So we've got concept of state neglect, 15th Amendment exemption, and Article 1, Section 4, federal elections jurisprudence. Bradley wrote his circuit opinion. He circulated it widely. Now, this is an important thing, because it's against this widely circulated opinion that Chief Justice Waite could use shorthand in 1876. Bradley's 1874 circuit opinion was really, really influential in a way that's bizarre today. Between 1882 and 1903, this opinion was actually cited as the authoritative opinion for Cruikshank. That's weird. That doesn't happen anymore, where a circuit case is cited instead of the Supreme Court case to stand for the doctrine in Cruikshank. Very, very important. It means that people regarded Bradley's opinion as authoritative legally. He circulated it among what were essentially law digests. He gave it to the cabinet. He gave it to major members of the House of Representatives. He sent it down to judges in the South. So wide circulation. The core of his opinion, and this is this old vocabulary of rights, and this gets a little bit technical. This is a strange distinction to modern ears, but it was a distinction that was conventional in the 19th century. Two kinds of rights. On the one hand, there were what were called declared rights. In other words, secured, guaranteed. Same word, mean the same thing. For declared rights, these were natural rights. They were conceived as natural rights that the Constitution then protected. So they pre-existed the Constitution, but the Constitution protected them, so they were secured. The other kind of right was called a created right, conferred, granted. These were rights that the Constitution created itself, so they did not pre-exist the Constitution. So we've got two kinds of rights, the natural rights that were secured by the Constitution, new positive rights created by the Constitution. This was a conventional distinction in the 19th century. What Bradley did with this distinction was attempt to build a systematic view of all three amendments. He was the only justice on the Supreme Court. Are you okay? We have to take care of you.
It's okay.
he was the justice who tried to build a synthetic jurisprudence for all three amendments. And let me start by just sketching this notion of state neglect. Now, this is not a notion that the Department of Justice ever used. The Department of Justice, from what I understand so far, never used this concept of state neglect to prosecute anybody. It remained available given the texts of the Supreme Court decisions, but it was not a theory that the Department of Justice put into practice. Now, what is this concept? The concept held that the federal government could prosecute private individuals if three conditions were met. One, the individual had to interfere with what were called civil rights at the time, and I'll say more about this notion in a second. The interference had to be on account of the race of the victim, and there had to be a record of state failure or refusal to prosecute the crime. So that permits punishment of a Klansman if that Klansman interfered in, for example, the physical integrity of a person, if they did it on account of race, and if the state had a record of systematically failing to punish this kind of violence. Now, the evidence is that observers at the time perceived this concept of state neglect in Bradley's 1874 circuit opinion. Let me just read one thing. Evidence is crucial. This is from the circuit opinion from Bradley. He's discussing the duty and the power of the federal civil right. He's discussing the duty and power of federal civil rights enforcement under the 14th Amendment. And he says this duty and power, quote, take their inception from the moment that the state fails to comply with the duty enjoined or violates the prohibition imposed. Here's the Chicago Tribune quoting the New Orleans Picayune. So this is the Picayune. This is a Democratic paper being quoted by a Republican paper. They're paraphrasing Bradley. Quote, the moment that the state fails to comply with the duties enforced upon it, the United States is called on to interfere. And the interference of Congress when a state is ready to punish a violation of these rights is unnecessary, injudicious, and illegal. When a state refuses this right, Congress has the power to pass the laws to enforce the amendment. Congress also has the power to secure these rights against individuals. So the Chicago Tribune is perceiving this concept of state neglect in Bradley's opinion. We also have circuit court opinions from the time, which are not included in any of the literature on this, that also show that observers are perceiving this concept in the opinion. Now, key element of this notion of state neglect, it only applies to this thing called civil rights. Today, we have a very expansive definition of this term. At the time, this notion was much narrower, and it was limited by moderate mainstream Republicans like President Grant, like all of his appointees to the courts, to the rights listed in the Civil Rights Act of 1866, right to hold property, sue, contract, testify in court, the right to be subject to the same criminal penalties, narrow group of rights, key thing, the right to public accommodations, the right to marry across racial lines, the right to integrated public schools, those were called social rights at the time by moderate mainstream Republicans. And mainstream Republicans could be absolutely committed to this notion of civil rights defined by the Act of 1866 and absolutely derisive about public accommodation rights. So you could have somebody be genuinely horrified about the failure to punish the Klan, but sound like a racist bigot when it came to integrated schools or cross-race marriage or public accommodations. So this term racist is really not helpful when it comes to distinguishing between moderate centrist Republicans, those kinds appointed by Grant, and Democrats, or even radical Republicans. Radical Republicans, the whole shebang, public accommodations, integrated schools, interracial marriage, and the Civil Rights Act. But the moderate Republicans, the centrist Republicans, these were the guys appointed by Grant. We need to understand their racial ideologies. And this is also what helps make sense of the civil rights cases. We have to understand that somebody could express genuine ridicule and contempt for a claim to public accommodation rights, but be absolutely certain and committed to this idea that an unpunished Klansman could be prosecuted by the federal government. So this notion was built into the state neglect concept. Since I'm rapidly running out of time, let me fast forward. I want to talk about this 15th Amendment exemption idea, because this is the idea that the Department of Justice picked up on in continuing their prosecutions after the Cruikshank decision. Now, remember, the 15th Amendment exemption, well, actually, I haven't said this yet, so let me say this for the first time. You've got this notion of secured rights, just to reiterate, this notion of secured rights, natural rights, protected by the Constitution, newly created rights, new granted rights. This notion of secured rights pertain to the Civil Rights Act of 1866, the right to life, the right to have your body protected, the right to property, the right to contract. These were natural rights protected by the Constitution. Bradley articulated a theory of congressional enforcement that said, Congress can protect all kinds of rights, but it matters what kinds of rights these are. If it's a secured right, Congress can only protect the right if there is state action. The state has to deny the right before the federal government can come in and protect it. Neglect was also conceived as a form of action. So when it came to physical integrity, The idea was Congress could come in and protect it if the state denied rights in some way, and denial included failure to punish. Voting was a created right. Voting was granted by the Constitution. And the 15th Amendment, as Bradley saw it, created a new right. Even though the 15th Amendment, just like the 14th Amendment, had prohibitory language in it. So one of the things Bradley did was that he disregarded the text of the 15th Amendment. He disregarded the prohibitory language, and he said, you know what's important about the 15th Amendment? It's not that there's prohibitory language. What's important is that it creates a new right. And so he said the federal government could prosecute private individuals who interfered in voting regardless of state behavior. This is really interesting, and this is something that he did on his own. This is not something he had to do. He clearly was motivated to do it. Something had to motivate him to look beyond the text and to say, look, what's important here is the right. And what's interesting is that Chief Justice Waite, in his opinion for Cruikshank, repeats what Bradley says. The problem with the 15th Amendment counts is that they didn't specify a racial motive. The year after Cruikshank, 1877, Chief Justice Waite gives us United States versus Butler, where Butler explicitly articulates this 15th Amendment exemption. Nobody knows about this case. Cases later, as late as 1901, 1903, Bradley is being quoted by district courts for this 15th Amendment exemption idea, this idea that you don't need state action to prosecute under the 15th Amendment. Now, these later prosecutions were not widespread, they were not vigorous, they were not vibrant, but they were still there, and they still represented a complicated relationship to this changing political context. And so when Waite gives his opinion in 1876, what I'm suggesting is that he spoke in a shorthand. He repeated the key aspects of Bradley's 1874 opinion. And he spoke in shorthand because it looked like Republicans were about to lose the 1876 election. The Republicans had gotten their butts kicked in the 1874 election. There was an economic panic in 1873. It threw the country into a depression. The Republican Party could not deal with the depression. They could not formulate economic policy to right the nation's economic ship. And there was also corruption in the Grant administration. Any reasonable observer in 1876 could look at the situation and say, you know what, it looks like the Republicans could really lose. Now imagine you're the Supreme Court. If you have a predisposition to be supportive of voting rights enforcement, but you know that the explicit repetition of Bradley's 1874 opinion could hurt your party, and it could hurt your party because by 1876, civil rights enforcement had become a liability for the Republican Party. If you're the court, you're not going to give a recitation of the facts in the Colfax massacre. You're not going to repeat Bradley's explicit language because that's going to hurt your party. What you're going to do is you're going to telescope it. You're going to signal in shorthand, here are the tools that remain available to you, but I'm not going to say so explicitly. I'm going to try to help my party, but you know what? I'm also going to protect my butt because the court doesn't like to risk its own legitimacy. If the Democrats had won the election, the very first thing they would have done would have been to promptly ignore the Supreme Court if the Supreme Court has stated explicitly, here is his theory of rights. So by speaking in shorthand, the court did two things. They signaled the administration about the rights that were, that the theory of rights that was available to them, and they protected their own influence. Evidence supporting this interpretation, I'm going to wind this down, is that the Department of Justice, after Cruikshank, and this is so crucial, after Cruikshank, you have Attorney General Taft, and you have the Department of Justice using the rights theories that were articulated by Justice Bradley in 1874. We need to have these later cases, and we need to be able to trace back the rights theories. So we know that the Department of Justice properly interpreted Waite's signaling. We have evidence that the signaling was effective. But again, the political context to change, this is a period of decline for the Reconstruction Party. We can talk about this later, about the relationship between lowered, significantly lowered levels of enforcement and what was going on in the party. But the bottom line here is that it was not the court, it was not legal doctrine that handcuffed the Department of Justice. It was the power of the Klan in the South, it was politics, it was the economic depression. It was not doctrine that handcuffed Congress. It was politics. It was the unavailability of economic resources. So there's an ambiguity about Cruikshank today because the opinion looks like it doesn't do very much. But once we place it in relationship to the political context, once we recover this old language of rights, once we understand the theory of rights that the Department of Justice used in Butler, where Waite said explicitly, here's your 15th Amendment exemption. In Butler, Waite gives a very detailed recounting of a racial massacre. Waite, in this 1877 opinion, does everything that he did not do in the Cruikshank opinion. Very detailed description of a racial massacre, explicit statement about 15th Amendment exemption. He does everything that scholars want from Cruikshank, and I suggest that the reason we see this in Butler but don't see it in Cruikshank is that the Republicans had just won the election. The pressure was off. It was easier for Waite to say in 1877 what he could not say in 1876. But in any case, I want to close just on an emphasis that Cruikshank really should not be seen as any sort of victory. It was not a victory. Blacks were still voting after Cruikshank. We know that. We actually have known that since Morgan Kauser established that. Stanley Hirshen, back in 1962, had said that the Republican Party did not, in fact, abandon blacks to home rule until the 1890s. We had anomalous information for the last 40 years about the fact that Cruikshank did not close the door on black voting and that the Republican Party did not abandon blacks until 1890. But until we really have a full fleshed out recovery of this old legal vocabulary, this old rights distinction, and a much better account of the Republican Party and what was happening to them between 1876 and 1890, a much more nuanced, much more complicated picture of this case really hasn't been available. So this case does matter today, but what I would suggest is that if we get rid of these anachronistic understandings of the account, new interpretations become available. It's not clear that the 15th Amendment exemption would apply today. I don't think courts would apply it because it involves notions of natural rights. And if this notion of state neglect, if courts want to extend it to, for example, gender-based violence or exclusions based on disability, that would be a legal decision. History can't answer that question. Threshold questions unaddressed by the court. We don't know what their definition of a racially based motive would be. We do know that the Department of Justice met this obstacle. They won cases by alleging a racial motive. We don't have enough case law to be able to know whether the court actually was instantiating a very, very high burden. We don't know that. It actually might have been a meetable burden. It's hard to know that for sure. But contemporary questions remain about how to bring this notion of state neglect into the 20th century. But nevertheless, these concepts were there, and many, 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 many contemporaneous observers in the 19th century perceived these concepts. So I'll stop there.
Thanks. Last but not least of our speakers today is Professor Linda Dodd, to my right. Professor Dodd is an assistant professor of law here at WCL, where she teaches and specializes in constitutional law and theory, constitutional tort litigation, and jurisprudence. She received her JD from Yale Law School and her PhD in politics from Princeton University. She's currently working on a book manuscript that examines the history of Section 1983 from its origins in the Civil Rights Act of 1871 to the contemporary era, with a special focus on the political debates regarding civil rights enforcement strategies. So, Linda.
Thanks. I find both of these commentators' positions juxtaposed against one another fascinating because I do think that they reflect different conceptions of the role of the court in the broader political system. A lot of people who blame the court for the end of Reconstruction looking at cases like Slaughterhouse and Cruikshank, expect the court to behave like a counter-majoritarian institution, that they should be, you know, just principled, independent interpreters of these broad, open-ended phrases in the 14th Amendment, and completely, you know, detached from the broader political environment. One of the things that political scientists who have a more historical bent do is try to reinsert the court into the broader political system. And so in Professor Brandwein's work, she, along with some other political historians, have been trying to situate the Reconstruction era Supreme Court decisions in a very complicated story about you know, the changing, declining fortunes of the Republican Party during the 1870s through the 1890s. So I find it fascinating. When I first read about Cruikshank and also read a little bit more about the background, you don't get the story, as they mentioned, in Waite's opinion, the Supreme Court opinion, the very short opinion. You know, I was shocked. There are many stories like that about atrocities committed during Reconstruction. So, like Charles Lane, you know, I want to look for the good guys and the bad guys, and I'm not so sympathetic to Bradley. So there's, you know, something about Professor Brandwein's approach that is, you know, both appealing and somewhat disconcerting, because she's looking at sort of the doctrinal structure and saying, okay, well, you can take from this, you know, some principles that show that they were moderate Republicans, and, you know, perhaps, you know, racist in a way that was more moderate than some. She's not exonerating them completely or suggesting that they're not racist. Yet I still wonder whether Lincoln and Grant could have had an opportunity to appoint to the court more racially progressive justices if they had chosen to emphasize that part during the appointments process. Grant himself appointed 4 justices at the time, including Bradley, including Waite, who you've heard mentioned today, and 2 others, Ward Hunt and William Strong. It is known today by historians that Grant was more sympathetic to the rights of the freedmen. He's had a bad reputation among historians for many years, but I think he's experiencing a kind of revival. He's experiencing more respect from historians, and people are recognizing that, especially in 1871 and 1872, under the leadership of Attorney General Amos T. Ackerman, he really did make an effort to secure the rights of freedmen in the South. And you heard mention of the military occupation in some regions of South Carolina. It was really extraordinary. He did a lot. So my research has focused on, you know, exactly what went into his choices for the Supreme Court nominations. And I think Charles Lane's work goes into a little bit more detail about Bradley's own ideological views, his previous writings before he was appointed to the court. And, you know, he didn't give any signals that he was going to be very racially progressive. And, you know, we don't need to go into a huge amount of detail about that. But, you know, to me it is a missed opportunity. There were people like Amos T. Ackerman, hopefully, who didn't have political scandals, you know, waiting to erupt in the confirmation process. Grant had problems with that, I know. But there were opportunities to appoint others. So that was a choice, and that was a missed opportunity. Then the other thing I want to say about Professor Brandwein's very complicated structure, she's convinced me that the circuit court opinion in Cruikshank, you know, does offer these signals to the Department of Justice. She mentioned the 15th Amendment argument, which is, you know, an anti-textualist argument. He actually just erased the state action requirement in the 15th Amendment. You know, that he can't be a complete racist. He can't be completely uncaring about civil rights enforcement if he did that. That's significant. But I'm wondering why it's historically significant that we uncover the state neglect concept. And we just had this very long lunch discussing this. So this isn't for the benefit of Professor Brandwein, but it's just to throw it out here. The state neglect concept, as she mentioned, was never used in a prosecution by Department of Justice U.S. Attorney. When could it have been used? The way that Bradley introduced the concept is that he said it has to be connected with a 14th Amendment violation motivated by racial animus of some sort. What about lynching prosecutions? Is there a statutory criminal civil rights provision that could be used to reach private actors using a kind of state neglect doctrine? Well, no. I mean, if you look at the circuit court opinion in Cruikshank, the provision, Section 6 of the 1870 Civil Rights Act, he said was unconstitutional. So he struck it down. In United States versus Harris, there was another provision in another Civil Rights Act. There were many Civil Rights Acts passed by the Reconstruction Congresses. The Section 2 of the 1870 Civil Rights Act was also struck down for the reason that it wasn't limited to state failures to protect. It just referred generally to conspiracies by private or public actors, and the court said, you know, that is unconstitutional because it hasn't established state action. There is no required element of state action. Okay, so, you know, Bradley's state neglect theory, this alternative kind of more interesting state action doctrine, is useless given the statutes that we had at the time that were overly broad and didn't distinguish between failures to protect and just general conspiracies to violate rights. So, you know, fast forward to the 20th century, the Department of Justice is always going back to these Reconstruction era statutes to try to revive them. When there was a resurgence of lynching in the mid part of the 20th century, they realized that they couldn't use these statutes because the only time that you could prosecute is if you had a police officer involved in some way, or maybe a jailer who'd opened the door and participated in the lynching. So they turned to alternative theories under due process, and that's a different, more complicated story about access to a trial. So, you know, I do think it's interesting to read Bradley's opinion accurately, but I wonder what difference it makes in, you know, in practice. For me, I think the more atrocious opinion from Reconstruction is the slaughterhouse cases. And I guess if we are thinking about the contemporary ramifications of Reconstruction era civil rights cases, I'd focus on slaughterhouse more than Cruikshank. I think Cruikshank is, you know, a horrible story, and it hadn't been told yet. But if I was trying to think of a way to sue the government for failing to protect, I might try to revive the Privileges or Immunities Clause and overturn slaughterhouse. And even though slaughterhouse is not a Wake Court opinion, it was one of the final opinions during the Chase Court, I don't care, so I'm going to mention it today. And, you know, there are older cases that interpreted the meaning of the Privileges and Immunities Clause in Article 4, and there were some kind of definitive interpretations of what privileges and immunities might mean. One of the rights that has traditionally been understood to be included among those is the right of protection. And so if you're seeking a way to hold the state accountable, under either a criminal enforcement strategy or what I study, which would be a private civil rights case under Section 1983, why not use that as your doctrinal hook? And it would be similar to a state neglect theory. You'd have to come up with some threshold of failure. You'd have to show that they knew about it or they had some control over the parties involved, and yet they failed to intervene. But once you've flesh this out a little bit, then you might have a basis for prosecuting for failures to prevent forms of private violence or suing for damages. What's interesting about the Privileges and Immunities Clause is that it's experiencing a revival among legal scholars. You've heard, you know, some interesting arguments about Cruikshank, but there are lots of people, not just in law schools who are professors, but people out in think tanks now who are arguing for a revival of privileges and immunities. One interesting argument has been presented in the past couple of months by the Constitutional Accountability Center. This is a group of activists who work in conjunction with some Yale Law professors, actually, Akilah Maher and Jack Balkin, who've decided that they're going to be liberal originalist textualists. So they're trying to take, you know, the legitimacy of originalism and use it for liberal purposes to revive the Privileges or Immunities Clause. And there are other organizations involved in this effort. The American Constitution Society, which, as you now know, is the Obama administration's think tank, associate of some sort, and the Brennan Center for Justice, which is associated with New York University Law School. So there are lots of people out there, not just academics, who are thinking about reviving the Privileges and Immunities Clause. And what makes it interesting to me is that they're getting support from very conservative jurists like Clarence Thomas, who think that you can use privileges and immunities as a doctrinal hook, not for suing social workers for failing to protect young children, but you can use it as a doctrinal hook for something like the right to possess guns. Now, if you have that kind of merging, you know, of ideological camps, it seems like this might happen soon. So it's an exciting time, I think, for people who are wondering what the contemporary relevance of the Reconstruction era cases might be for today. I think that, you know, 15 years ago, no one would have said that the Second Amendment would ever be revived. And look where we are now after Heller. I think we may be in a similar position with privileges and immunities. So maybe 15 years from now, we'll have the emergence of a new doctrinal strand with those cases.
Great, thanks. So I'm going to use the moderator's privilege to put a couple of questions to our panelists before we open it up to all of you. So I guess my first question is for Pam and Chuck, given Linda's comments. I mean, I had the same reaction, which is whether, you know, Cruikshank is the more important precedent or just a really sad story that we've misunderstood, and that the far greater weight on current constitutional doctrine is indeed the Slaughterhouse cases. I'm not sure I share Linda's optimism or pessimism, I'm not sure which one it is, about resuscitating the Privileges or Immunities Clause, since I think it's remarkable that the strongest voices in favor of resuscitating it today are conservatives who want to incorporate Heller. But I do want to put the question this way. I mean, what is it possible to understand what comes after the Slaughterhouse cases without first grappling with the Slaughterhouse cases themselves? And with the extent to which Justice Miller's opinion really does seem to run, at least in some direction, at odds with what, at least, you know, with one view of what the 14th Amendment was meant to do.
Well, let
me just say briefly, Bradley's jurisprudence has the capacity to do everything that incorporation does, if you interpret race-based motive in a generous way. You have to be willing to do that. If you're not willing to do that, then it can't do the work. And just briefly, let me just respond to something, Linda, you asked about whether state neglect had any statutory justification back then. It does in the civil rights cases when Bradley is constructing under color of law. That is the state neglect concept. He cites 1977, 1978, 1979, and 5510. So there are four statutes on the books at the time that can be used to ground the state neglect concept?
I'd sort of like to begin with a joke. I hope it's going to work. It's an old Jewish joke about this mythical town in Poland called Helm, where everybody's always doing absurd things. And there's a judge who's a rabbi in Helm, and he has a little assistant, his law clerk or rabbi clerk with him, and the first farmer comes to him with his explanation of the dispute, and the rabbi says, "You're right." And the second farmer comes and says, "Wait, rabbi, you haven't heard my story yet." So the second farmer tells his side of the story, and the rabbi says, "But you're right." And then the law clerk whispers in the rabbi's ears, he says, "Rabbi, they can't both be right." To which the rabbi says, "You're right, too." And that's sort of the way I felt about what Professor Brandwine had to say earlier, which is we can't both be right. But actually, I think we are both right. And yet, even though I agree with a lot of what she had to say about the long-range effect of Cruikshank, and that I hope I didn't seem to be saying that Cruikshank sort of brought down the curtain on black voting rights in the South, I agree with her very much. It's a much more complicated story. I do think I disagree with her probably about Justice Bradley, and one of the reasons is the relationship of Slaughterhouse to Cruikshank. So if I could sort of go into that for just a second. Bradley, it should be noted, was a dissenter in Slaughterhouse and dissented with an opinion that was extremely expansive about the scope of federal protection under the 14th Amendment. Remember, the case in Slaughterhouse was brought by a bunch of white butchers who were complaining that there was a state monopoly that was denying them their right to labor freely in New Orleans. And their litigator, their lawyer, was a man called John Campbell, who had been on the Supreme Court before the Civil War, but defected, in effect, to join the Confederate government. And after the war, moved to New Orleans and began harassing the Republican state government with all these frivolous lawsuits like the Slaughterhouse case. In any case, in that case, Bradley ruled that, yes, the 14th Amendment gives a cause of action to people who are claiming that their 14th Amendment rights, and indeed that the 14th Amendment rights have been violated by the state of Louisiana setting up one slaughterhouse where everybody would kill their animals in a central location so that the blood and guts wouldn't flow through the whole city. And so I think what has to be accounted for in some ways is the migration of Bradley from then to the later Bradley that we know of. And it's a hard story, and a lot of people have struggled to interpret it. My own view is that one key of it does lie in his view in Cruikshank. This indictment that he struck down is a hard indictment to read. It's over 100 and some pages, and it's written in numbing 19th century prose. But the heart of it is that in each count, there is a mention of the race of the victim. In some, this is phrased as, you know, so-and-so, comma, being of African descent, or et cetera. And in others, it is on account of being an African descent. But in other words, the indictment, the text of the indictment, to any reasonable person, leaves no real doubt as to the fact that race is a cause, if not a motive, of this crime. And Bradley chooses to read that very, very narrowly, that language very narrowly. So he could have established the very same doctrine Professor Branwen is talking about while upholding this indictment. He could have found this indictment to have sufficiently declared the racial motive that he was demanding from future cases, and thereby have set the bar that much lower for federal prosecutors in the future. And that's why I feel that there's something more going on there with Bradley than protecting, than trying to, you know, keep alive this cause of action. Indeed, he seems to me to have done the opposite. He chose the starkest example possible of a racial massacre to show that even that wasn't actionable under these statutes. And he sent the opinion, I feel he sent the opinion out to these judges in the various districts of the South to show them that very thing. They all knew from the newspapers what had happened at Colfax. And he wanted to put the stop right then and there to any more prosecutions in their districts. Excuse me. And I agree with Professor Branwen. I don't think this is because Joseph Bradley wanted black people to be killed. In fact, I think there's good evidence that he was probably appalled by what happened at Colfax. But I think he was more concerned with the potential this held for creating further distracting and needless conflict between North and South. And so that I think it's actually, it's in its own way a little building block of the compromise of 1876-77. I learned a lot from what Professor Branwen said, and I agree with most of it, but I do think we probably disagree on how to interpret what Bradley did in this case.
Well, it's okay.
Please.
A couple of things. I think Bradley's dissent in Slaughterhouse, and I think actually both Fields and Bradley's dissents haven't been as well understood as they need to be, and I think there's going to be continuing conversation about Bradley's dissent. And I say that for a couple of reasons. Bradley and Field have both been identified as sort of the fathers of substantive due process, and people sort of look at Lochner and they point a finger at both Bradley and Field. But what they forget is that Bradley and Field diverged immediately after Slaughterhouse, and there were many cases where Bradley was willing to uphold economic regulation where Field wasn't. So it's clear that Bradley had a different idea in his mind, a different vision of what he was doing in Slaughterhouse than Field did because of their later divergence. He gives up his incorporation thesis because he loses. I mean, there aren't five justices for incorporation. So he's forced to back off of the incorporation position. He had no choice. And that became clear in Cruikshank. On this question of, quote, migration, yes, the conventional view is that Bradley migrated, but in fact, if you unpack the under color of law language in the civil rights cases, and I didn't talk about any of that here, there's a concept of state neglect there, and he's presenting it again in shorthand. And again, we have this commitment to civil rights, or at least leaving the door open. I'm more comfortable with that language, leaving the door open to the state neglect concept in the civil rights cases while expressing clearly racist views when it comes to public accommodation rights. So I'm not convinced there, in fact, is a doctrinal migration for Bradley only on the questions of state neglect. On incorporation, absolutely. He loses and he gives up that position. On the question of the indictments, some of the counts of the indictment listed race, many of the counts of the indictment did not. And the counts of the indictment that the federal government held onto, the ones that they did not chuck, because they chucked most of them, right? On those indictments, the racial motive was not listed. And Beckwith sort of had to throw all of this against the fan, see what sticks. Some of his indictments, even many of the counts had racial motive. Many of them did not. And so it's not clear that Bradley could have used the indictments as they stood. Beckwith did not give him every count with the racial motive. Now, something I absolutely agree with you on is that Bradley introduced the racial motive on his own. That was not required. The Republicans and the Reconstruction Congresses clearly wanted to protect political violence and racial violence against the Klan. They wanted to protect both white Republicans and black Republicans. When Bradley introduces the racial motive into his concept of state neglect, this is the court imposing an obstacle to the Republican administration, and the court does this. So now the question is why. My suspicion is that federalism concerns are at the root here, and that the court, and Les Benedict just talked about this dominance of a state-centered federalism. The justices were willing to expand federal oversight power over the states, but they were very, very nervous about this, and they used the notion of racial motive as a way of limiting it. Now, this is the court doing it. The court did not have to do it. I think we can explain it by a 19th century legal culture that privileged state-centered federalism, and Bradley's distinction between racial violence and political violence was the court's attempt to preserve federalism. Now, again, we come back to the question of what is the threshold? How do we define racial motive? You can have either low thresholds for this or very high thresholds for this. The 20th century Supreme Court has imposed a very high threshold. The animus standard is almost impossible to meet. It's not clear that that's in fact what Bradley had in mind. The fact is that the federal government won cases where they did allege racial motive and they succeeded. Now, part of the problem for us in the 20th century is that there aren't that many of these cases. We have a handful of them, but we don't know enough about all of these cases to be able to get a fix on where this threshold is. So I think part of the evidence that we would like to see to evaluate Bradley on whether or not what his motives were for introducing a racial motive, we don't have the evidence we need to evaluate if this was pretextual or if he really just wanted some way to keep the federal government within boundaries that Bradley thought were acceptable. So part of this, I'm not sure we're going to be able to know on how high a threshold Bradley had for racial violence. But we do know Again, the federal government met that standard on several occasions, so it couldn't have been an impossible standard to meet.
Just one last point, if I might. There is a puzzle, which I'm sure we're never going to get the answer to, about the Supreme Court opinion in this case. Actually, there's many puzzles, but one that I like is the following. Professor Brandwein is absolutely right. The U.S. government's brief in that case, it's a lousy brief, but it's a very defensive brief, and it does only defend, I believe it's either two or four counts of this indictment. And it essentially just says, well, the others have technical problems we won't talk about. So the case comes to the court only having really, in the posture where the court really only has to deal with those two counts to reach a result. But instead, the court goes through all 16 counts of the indictment to show why they're no good. It, in effect, as she said, it recapitulates all the objections that Bradley had in his opinion. In other words, they were obviously attempting to shape the doctrine as opposed to just decide this case. And what strikes me, and I think she alluded to it, what strikes me, and I confess annoys me about Cruikshank, is how activist this case is. This is a very activist court. Now, in part, that's understandable because these enactments, both the Enforcement Act and the underlying amendments, are all brand new. There's a lot of blank slate to be written on. But I repeat, this case had been argued in front of a jury with the circuit judge, William Woods, sitting there. William Woods was the circuit judge for the... Oh, that's Rudy Giuliani's wife, I think. I can't take that, sorry. And he was known, Woods, in the Fifth Circuit, had upheld Enforcement Act indictments on similar fact patterns in the past. This case, Cruikshank, in effect, through the elaboration of the previously non-existent doctrine that Justice Bradley elaborates, does not only add to the doctrine, but in effect overturns the existing circuit doctrine. In a case, I repeat, where the necessity for doing that to solve the problem posed by the case is not abundantly clear. And so I think there was a lot of activism about this court. And again, not to be too disputatious here, but I think well, I'll just leave it there. But I think there's a lot going on here that's very mystifying.
So what, I guess
I was going to ask Chuck something.
Okay.
What case did Bradley of Woods's overturn? Are you talking about U.S. v. Hall?
Yes.
He didn't. Hall was overturned on incorporation grounds, because at that point they had Slaughterhouse in the interim.
Right.
But Cruikshank did not overturn Hall on any notion of state neglect, because Hall did not get to the issue of motive. It did not say you had to or not have a racial motive because it was a Bill of Rights case. So they weren't worried about that in Hall. So the issue was open in 1874. Now, I agree with you that it was activist in taking on all of these other dimensions
right.
of the case. But in taking on the Equal Protection Clause, Bradley was actually doing two things. In one sense, he was limiting doctrine by imposing that racial motive, right? Because you can't have political motives anymore. So that looks narrow and that looks nasty, and he's really contracting what the Republicans in Congress wanted to do. But there's another dimension of this, because he's also signaling the Department of Justice, here's what you need to do to bring a count under the Equal Protection Clause. He's giving the federal government a blueprint for how to proceed under the Equal Protection Clause. So on the one hand, it's constricting because he's limiting equal protection to race, not textual, not demanded by anything, absolutely. But on the other hand, he's saying, here's the blueprint for bringing an indictment. And so it's not Beckwith's fault that he left out the racial motive. He had no reason to assume that that was required, that there was nothing before Bradley's opinion that said it had to be a racial motive. This is the court's construction. So this isn't his fault. So he, I think, was justifiably angry that, well, who said that this rule exists? This the Congress? This wasn't Congress's rule. He did it right. This is Bradley's and the court's creation. I'm suggesting because of federalism, but at the same time, the state neglect concept could ultimately, not in Cruikshank anymore, but in the future, do what the federal government wanted to do. Now, part of the problem here is that there's a shifting political landscape. And after the panic of 1873 and the economic depression and the shifting civil rights, support for civil rights in the northern population, the oomph went out of enforcement. And so the priorities for the Republican Party became more constrained. They couldn't do so much, so they shifted onto voting rights cases only. And in shifting onto voting rights cases only, they had a doctrine that was very useful. They had 15th Amendment doctrine. They had federal elections doctrine. The court had already given it the thumbs up, said, here's the imprimatur, go for it. And so they went for it. So I think there's also a political story about why the Department of Justice did not seize on the state neglect opening, even though doctrinally they could have. So again, complications.
I'm going to move this on a little bit. I mean, I guess this suggests that the panel's misnamed it should be Justice Bradley and the Legacies of Reconstruction. So I wonder, I mean, maybe I can find something where Chuck and Pam can both just tell me that I'm wrong and agree with each other. just to sort of to be selfish and tie this to something that I'm interested in my own research and writing, one chapter that I think is often left out of conventional conversations on the Supreme Court's role in these cases on the whole period is the role of the Posse Comitatus Act, which is near and dear to my heart because of its dealing with the relationship between civil and military authority. The Posse Comitatus Act is enacted in 1878. Right by the newly elected or not so newly elected Congress in the 1876 election, and it says there will be no resort to the use of the military for civilian law enforcement absent some express statutory command, right? Absent some express authorization. And I wonder, given the evidence that the Republicans still were, or that there still were attempts at voting rights prosecutions after the Compromise of 1877. Is it possible that maybe the real culprit in taking the wind out of the sails is the reality that the military was no longer going to be a backstop, right? That the U.S. attorneys could no longer rely on the Army if it found that its attempts to enforce process were actually being frustrated by the KKK and other Southern groups?
It's plausible. I know the Army wanted to get out of that business very badly. Particularly in Louisiana, there were tremendous conflicts within the military about it, and it was viewed, the whole role was viewed as politicizing the Army. There were, interestingly, the partisan affiliations of Army officers were very well known at that time, and particularly a lot depended on, you know, what state they came from originally and that sort of thing. And some officers were thought to be radical Republicans, and others were known to be sort of Southern sympathizers and the rest. And the whole business was stirring up trouble within the Army, partisan trouble. But I think a bigger factor was the whole desire to take the sort of military boot off the neck of the South, the South's desire to remove it, by the way, and this was something that North and South could sort of agree on. And I'm not as well versed in that as I need to be, but I'm not sure that it was, at least, I'm sure what you're saying is true, that that was one of the consequences. Whether that was one of the intentions behind it, I'm less certain about.
When Attorney General Taft issued his circular to federal marshals in 1876, it's not a problem. He's got Article 1, Section 4, right. And he can use the federal elections statutes. He doesn't need the military anymore in the way that he used to. And if you look at the 1880 election, the rhetoric sounded like they'd gone back to 1870. I mean, it was exactly the same demarcation. He was still willing to use those marshals, and if he hadn't used those marshals even in 1880, the Democrats probably would have won that election. Mm-hmm. So they still are deploying federal officials. They weren't the military in the same way. It wasn't the Army in the same way, but there was still muscle that was being used in 1880.
But it's ironic, right, because then it suggests that maybe it's the expansion of the civil service
right? That because there wasn't. I mean, the federal government as a bureaucracy was still growing in this period.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
So they're small.
Yeah.
And so it's actually.
Yeah.
But for that growth, right? But for the fact that there actually now were a sufficient number of marshals to deploy, maybe they would have had to fall back on the military.
Well, I mean, I think the politics of this is so complicated
right.
because the northern population was moving, you know. But what's interesting is that the northern population is moving away from civil rights enforcement, but a group of Republican elites, the regular Republicans, was not, and they were trying to balance how do you win an election when margins are razor thin, and it's tough. So they use these federal marshals, even though it's not the military, and even though they struggle against the Southern Democratic press that's beating the drums against, you know, this idea of the boot.
So you've all been very patient. I wanted to give you all a chance to ask questions of your own. I would say come to the microphone, but if you just want to be loud so that we can hear you, that would probably be fine. Or you can leave me to ask another question, which could be dangerous. Jim.
This has been wonderful, and thank you all for doing this. I guess the one
Well, the 13th Amendment was the basis for the Civil Rights Act of 1866, but most of the Reconstruction-era statutes that, you know, that we now have that originally came from the 1866 Act, like Section 1981, Section 1982, Section 242, they were all reenacted after the passage of the 14th Amendment, and different sections of the Enforcement Act of 1870. There are multiple sections of that act that have been turned into different statutes, and we heard discussion today of Section 6, which was the statute at issue in a couple of the cases mentioned. So the 13th Amendment issue, you know, I think is not so relevant for the voting rights cases, but it was discussed a lot. And, you know, this is a general question I have about the kind of upshot of these cases and whether or not the Republican Justice Department officials are good guys or bad guys. Because it seems to me after all of Bradley's doctrinal innovations, and, you know, I think Pamela and I have different views about this. My view is to be a little cynical. You know, they were enforcing voting rights in the South, you know, trying to save Southern Republicanism. They weren't trying to use these doctrines innovatively to prosecute lynchers. You know, they wanted some votes. So that's a more cynical view. And so, you know, this is the heyday of lynching, as you know. Lynching continued throughout the 20th century, and there were efforts to look at any possible theory to use as a basis for prosecuting lynchers. And the 13th Amendment, you know, was considered at different points to provide some sort of basis. That never really took hold with the civil rights section attorneys. Eventually, they turned to a due process theory. So, as Risa Golubov has argued, the 13th Amendment became sort of the cornerstone of a labor rights jurisprudence. And I guess James Gray Pope has made this argument way before she did. I haven't seen mention of the 13th Amendment as the basis for civil rights enforcement for personal security cases or cases involving violence associated with voting.
Although there is, I mean, not in voting, right, but there is, I mean, I teach, or at least I try to teach in common law, the Jones versus Alfred Mayer, right?
Yeah, well, that's section 1981, so
that's... I thought it was 82.
Right, oh, it is 82, but those are both... Those were repassed.
No, right, but the majority in Jones, right, upholds it as an exercise of Congress's power under Section 2 of the 13th Amendment, right? And so, I mean, it's odd, right, because I think that was sort of the last moment of the Warren Court, right, vis-a-vis congressional power, is to suggest that, you know, Section 2 of the 13th Amendment actually allows some maneuvering mm-hmm. with regard to discrimination in public housing.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's true.
Right, that we've abandoned, right, because we just assume that, you know, with the Warren Court went mm-hmm. such a broad conception of the 13th Amendment. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, what Jim's suggesting is that there's room there, although I think that's more the historical question, which I'm least qualified to answer.
There's the critical difference here is between the radical Republicans and the centrist Republicans. And the centrist Republicans held the balance of power in the 39th Congress. And they insisted that any federal prosecution of private individuals be premised on state denial of rights. So that is not, that's a 14th Amendment theory. And at the time, the 14th Amendment, of course, you know, Hyman and Wycheck have established this, that 13th Amendment was not being enforced. Black codes were passed, and the Republicans thought, well, we need to do something. So they envisioned the Civil Rights Act of 1866 as a reiteration of kind of what they meant to do with the 13th Amendment. And same with the 14th Amendment. But what's interesting was when John Bingham brought forth his draft of the 14th Amendment, it initially said, Congress shall have the power to protect rights, da-da-da, no state action predicate. The centrist Republicans said, we're not taking this, because it gives Congress direct control over these rights, and we're going to put in the state action language. So that suggests that the centrist Republicans didn't follow, in a sense, the text of the 13th Amendment, that the way they understood the 13th Amendment was to, in fact, require a state denial of rights before you go in and you punish private lynching or private interference with rights. So you combine Hyman and Wycheck's historical work on the relationship of the 14th Amendment to the 13th Amendment, you factor in the centrist Republican rejection of Bingham's prototype of the 14th Amendment, and you come up with the conclusion that for the framers, you had to have state denial of rights before you could punish lynching or any kind of private violence. So the text of the 13th Amendment and the 13th Amendment itself was not operative during Reconstruction. It was the state denial of rights, but denial was also understood to include neglect. You have a funny look on your face.
No.
You're just processing. Yeah, so if you look at Jones versus Alfred Mayer, it actually has a historically invalid understanding of the 13th Amendment.
Right. Then who brought up the 13th Amendment?
Bradley was inconsistent on this. Hmm. He's coy in the civil rights cases where he says, we're going to treat the Civil Rights Act of 1866 as 14th Amendment legislation. And he does. But he's coy. He never says the Act of 1866 is legitimate under the 13th. He never tells us. So on the one hand, he articulates a broad theory of the 13th Amendment when he talks about the war of race. But on the other hand, he insists on a state neglect predicate when he's talking about things like violence. So he's unclear. I'm not sure he ever worked out this issue of, well, what's the language of the amendment, and then how do you protect it? Because life and liberty and all the things that the Klan was interfering with were secured rights. And under his theory of rights, regardless of the text of the 13th Amendment, and Bradley, we already know, ignores the text sometimes, it's about the nature of the right protected. So if it's physical liberty, he's going to require a state denial of rights before the feds can protect it.
Which is interesting, right? Because then it's Harlan, right, who has the more expansive view, right? That, you know, Harlan would make the public-private distinction, not the state action distinction anyway.
Right.
Partly because he ties the 13th and 14th together.
And Harlan also has a broader concept of civil rights.
Right.
Harlan was a radical Republican in terms of his conception of rights.
He just didn't tell anybody.
Right. But he's articulating a civil-social distinction that was actually the same as Frederick Douglass's.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Bradley who was articulating the centrist Republican position that distinguished sharply between the rights of in the 1866 Act versus public accommodation rights.
I think we have time for one more question, if anyone is willing and able.
Our discussion has been so definitive, it removed all questions from the minds of the audience.
Invoke
the 13th Amendment?
Yeah, as a basis for the 1865.
Not that I know of. I mean, they invoked Charles Sumner.
I know, they invoked his, yeah.
They invoked his memory, which leads you to think the act never would have passed if Sumner had not died.
There's not the 13th, but the 14th was invoked by some, interestingly, who argued that it was consistent with Slaughterhouse, that is, that the act was consistent with Slaughterhouse, that Slaughterhouse posed no, the interpretation of the 14th Amendment in Slaughterhouse posed no barrier to the Civil Rights Act. And that was the argument by John Lynch, who was actually one of the few African-American congressmen from Mississippi.
Right. The radical Republicans made that argument.
Yeah.
The centrists did not.
Great. Well, I hope you will join me in thanking our panelists for a fascinating and enlightening discussion. And thank you all for coming. There are still some cookies and fruit and drinks up in the little foyer, so feel free to take some on your way out. Thank you all for coming and for participating.
Thank you, Steve. You and I should someday we should sit down and